And then 8 days later, I collapsed. I had like 104 degree fever, and I have no idea what happened. I was completely gone. And Dave dragged me into one of two hospitals that they had in the country at the time. And I came out of it maybe two, three days later. I don't even know. Dave doesn't know either, because he was still in the haze of malaria himself. But the doctor said 2 more hours away from the hospital and you would have been dead.
So 61 days ago, I had the pleasure of hearing you speak at a creator event called Creator Camp, and I was inspired by a wide variety of people at the event, but your story in particular really inspired me because it showed what a lot of effort and a few decades can do when actually trying to build an international organization. So I just want to say it's an honor and privilege to have you on the podcast today and share your story.
Joey, it's that's very generous. Thank you so much. I'm super happy to be here.
So for those who are unfamiliar with who you are, how would you describe yourself and the work you've been dedicating yourself to for the past few decades?
Well, I founded Build On in 32 years ago, and Build On is a nonprofit organization. We run really intensive service learning programs in low resource high schools across the United States. We get kids involved in intensive local service, doing an investigation, looking at the issues and challenges in their communities, deciding how to take action through service, and then doing it and reflecting and demonstrating it. As part of that service component, students do local service, working with elders and homeless people and younger children. And they also do global service, building schools in some of the economically poorest countries in the world. So at this point, we have programs in Detroit, Chicago, Oakland, Boston, New York, the Bronx, South Bronx, Bridgeport, Connecticut. And we've now built 2,352 or something like that schools in Mali, Burkina Faso, and Senegal in West Africa, and Malawi in Southern Africa, and Nepal, and then also Haiti, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. So it's been just such a gift to be able to dedicate my life, you know, to 32 years to this cause. And I'm grateful for every minute of it.
I want to take it back to the childhood version of Jim. What characteristics of your childhood self, say your high school version of yourself, do you think enabled you to materialize so much impact across borders?
You know, I consider myself a pretty insecure high school kid who was just trying to be like everybody else. You know, whether you realized it or not, I just wanted to be as normal as possible. And I think unusually sensitive. I was really empathetic to other people, you know, when they were feeling down and out. And then, you know, I felt those emotions deeply myself. And I think that through Build On and the work that we've done, I realized that, you know, that I'm not like everybody else, that nobody is like anybody else, and that I should celebrate the ways I'm different and celebrate, you know, the different ideas and motivations that I have and embrace them, you know, not be afraid of them, not hide them, just go for it. And I think that the empathy that I developed, I probably got that from my mom. You know, that connected me to the people and the communities and the students that we work with. It made it really easy for me to connect, you know, with the communities. And it's been really amazing. You know, in retrospect, you see these things, but when you're in high school, man, it sucks. You know, you're just dealing with it.
When do you think that paradigm shift happened from insecurity to a sense of ability to actually do and materialize like real world change? When did that actually happen, if you could pinpoint that moment?
I can't pinpoint the moment. I think it took place over the course of 2 or 3 years, maybe more. I grew up in a small town in Michigan. And outside of a small town, actually, in Michigan. And, And I went to, I wanted to get out of my high school, get out of my town. So I went to Michigan State University, which has 50,000 undergrads, which is exactly what I wanted. I just wanted to be around a bigger world, a bigger universe, or immersed in a bigger world and universe. And I got that. And at those big, you know, university, state universities, it's kind of sink or swim. You're in there and either you're going to, you know, buckle down and get it done, or you're not, and you won't last. There's nobody keeping track of you, you know, and I kind of thrived in that environment. And I started to realize that if I worked hard and stayed focused, I could do some stuff. You know, I was making the honor, the dean's list, I think they called it, the, every term. And I'm like, I had no idea I had that in me. And then when I graduated from Michigan State, I had some good job offers, you know, and I've majored in finance, but I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to go that route yet. So I worked a couple jobs, waiting tables, framing houses, construction, and for about 6 or 8 months. And I was able to save enough money in that 6 months to travel for a year around the world. And so I bought a backpack and just started hitchhiking around the world. And I think it was, you know, that journey through college and then choosing an alternative route. This is like 1988, 1989. And I was, you know, I ended up in the Soviet Union. It was still the Soviet Union, and illegally, and just all these, but wherever I went, people were so wonderful and welcoming and generous. So I think over time, the seed was planted. And in terms of Build-On specifically, I think it started, you know, started to germinate for me when I went to India. So on this trip around the world, the first really developing country that I had visited was India. And I was totally overwhelmed by extreme poverty and the injustice of extreme poverty. And like I said, I'm from a small town. In Michigan, I'm like, I've never seen anything like this. I'm in Delhi, and it's just, it's crazy. And then I went to Nepal because I wanted to climb, go up into the Himalaya. And the poverty index is even worse in Nepal. And so I'm still kind of bewildered, you know, and I'm on my own just hitchhiking and doing whatever to get from point A to point B. And I left Kathmandu and got a bus to this place called Jiri, and I had to walk for 10 days. My goal was to go up into the Solokumbu region and track and climb and that sort of thing. But I had to walk through the rainforest for 11 days before you even get to the mountains. And I didn't know. And I took off on this journey in the middle of the monsoon season, which was a mistake because it rains like 18 hours a day in the monsoon. And I'm in a rainforest and it's just, everything's drenched. And I think on day 6 or 7, I passed through a village and I pulled off the trail, you know, just set my backpack down and wanted to dry off. And, you know, in the rainforest, there's a lot of leeches. So I had to take my shoes off and socks and just peel the leeches off. You did it every couple hours. And I was in this little tea house, which is a stone hut, you know, and this woman gave me some tea, which was awesome. And then she took off. I don't know where she went. And I'm all done drying off. And I'm like, where is everybody? I look out the window, which was about this big, you know, a tiny little 12 inch by 12 inch porthole in this stone hut. And all the people are out in the mud and in the rain dancing and celebrating. And I go out there and I'm like, what's going on? And it was a 2-day celebration. And this was the second day. These people didn't go home. They had been there partying and having this celebration for 48 hours. And they were celebrating the opening of a school that they had built, you know, and I was like, wow, I mean, that was amazing, especially, you know, comparing that to my experiences in Delhi and in India. And instead of seeing the injustice and the grinding nature of extreme poverty, I'm seeing the hope, you know, and the determination that a community has, even under these circumstances. And so that had an impact on me, but it's not like, boom, the light went off and this is what I'm going to do. I kind of just went on my merry way, went climbing up into the mountains, and I came back to the United, made it back to the States probably 4 or 5 months later, something like that. And, you know, I had seen, and I saw poverty in America much differently because I'd experienced poverty in developing countries. And I saw that same kind of joy, that same hope and inspiration that I saw in that village where they built the school. I saw that in American youth, you know, in our youth and people like you, Joey. And I wanted to act on it. But I totally chickened out and went on in the opposite direction and took a job with the largest financial services firm in the world, GE Capital. And it was a fast track job. And, you know, it's what I thought I wanted to do. It's what I trained for in college. And but I just had this growing ache. I don't know, this gnawing feeling. I had to act on what I had experienced. And so I finally got the courage up about a year and a half into this job to quit and to start build on.
What was the mental grappling that you had to go through when making that jump to take the jump into the unknown? I'm sure the sense of security gave you a level of confidence. There was a steady stream of money coming into your bank account every few months.
For the first time, like ever. Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of young people who listen to this podcast and they're grappling with the same exact idea of, should I take the leap? What was the mental process like for you to finally come to that decision?
You know, what happened is I had been thinking about it softly, and we had actually, maybe 6 months before I quit GE, we actually incorporated Build-On. You know, I did it in my spare time, and my brother Dave moved from Alaska to the East Coast here, and he got into it with me. So we co-founded Build-On, you know, together, and we started to gather volunteers, people that wanted to help, and we're trying to organize fundraisers. We partnered with two NGOs, you know, that would help us find villages where we could build schools in South America and Africa and Asia. And it was Brazil, Malawi, and Nepal. And they were great. And then I was in this kind of high pressure, fast track program. It was like an internal MBA. And I drew every 6 months, you rotated to a new position. And you also had to take all this coursework. And if you didn't get above an 80%, you were out. And that was okay. But I drew a rotation that was like an 80 to 90 hour a week job, right? And I knew people that had been in that rotation before. And I realized, well, I got it. It's one or the other. You know, because I can't, this thing is going to consume me, this job, you know. And so I talked to my parents about it. I talked to some close friends and my brother Dave, obviously. He was all like, yeah, let's go, you know. And so I knew it was going to be a challenge. But like I was saying earlier, I think that my life up until that point kind of prepared me to take a chance, to take a risk, to give it a shot, you know, because it's kind of all I'd been doing for the 3 or 4 or 5 years prior to that. So it felt natural, but it sucked after I quit. You mentioned mental, I think mental anguish. There was that and more.
It, you know, I'm a firm believer that you cannot become what you cannot see. I'm curious who you looked up to and who you saw as a role model when going into this huge journey of building thousands of schools. Who were the people that you looked up to that, you know, guided you towards your direction?
Well, that was the problem, Joey. Nobody had ever done anything like this. There was no model to look at. I mean, we're uniting, you know, youth from the South Bronx with people in West Africa to build schools. We're engaging these students to do intensive service work in their own communities, working with people that have HIV positive or have AIDS and need nutrition, and providing that nutrition, or working tutoring younger children. And these same kids are helping us build schools around the world. So there was nobody to talk to about that. Like, to ask, like, how do you do this? It just, my brother and I, and and a couple others, we just had to dive in and figure it out, you know, and that was the hard. That's the part I didn't see coming. You know what I mean? After I left GE, you know, we formed those partnerships and we identified places we build schools, and we were engaging about 200 kids in the program. But then, you know, 6 months in, we just hadn't raised a penny yet. And we had all these volunteers revved up that were into it. And you know, we started to get rejection letters, you know, because we sent out proposals for funding, and they were generous. You know, they not only said no, they also gave us, you know, three or four reasons why we would fail. And the worst part is that they were true. Like, we didn't know how to raise money. We didn't know how to build schools. We didn't know how to work with American youth, you know, and so the rejection made sense. And then, but it sucked because we had, you know, a pile of rejection letters. And then I got a fax message, which is old technology, but there was no access to the internet in 1991 when we started Build-On. And so I got a fax message from our partner in Malawi, Africa. And it said, "Today we announced to the village that you're going to come and build the school." And they immediately broke out in song and dance. And I remember it word for word. And he says the celebration went on for hours. And the last thing he wrote in that fax was, "Needless to say, if you fail to come, we'll be equally disappointed." I mean, the key word there is fail. We were failing, Joey. We were going down. It was not good. And I was in a terrible state mentally. I was, you know, just full of fear and anxiety. And I was, you know, I I'm trying to start an organization, my brother and I, and I couldn't talk about it. I was so stressed out and I couldn't sleep at night. And, you know, and it was like a downward spiral, you know, and one night, you know, one of these many sleepless nights, I woke up and just flipped, not woke up, I was already up, but I flipped on the light and gave up on trying to sleep. And my dad had sent me a Bible or given me a Bible. I don't remember if he sent it or not. And anyway, and I had it next to the bed, you know, so I open up the Bible randomly, you know, just, you know, there's several thousand pages in the Bible. I opened up randomly and the first sentence that I read was, "Fear is useless. What is needed is trust." I'm like, oh my. And I kept reading it to myself over and over again. And I realized that I was being paralyzed by my own fear. You know, I knew what was at stake, and that pressure was too much for me. Hundreds of children needed these schools that we were going to build, and American youth would be disillusioned if we failed. But I realized that you just got to peel back that fear and anxiety and just embrace it and go for it. Send it. Yeah.
A lot of young people are grappling with what scripture to follow, you know, what can be their North Star. And it seems like from your story, a Bible verse spoke to you and was that, you know, light of hope that you needed. Why was that the line that impacted you?
Well, I don't know if the Bible was the first thing, and this was the Gospel of Mark, chapter 5, verse 36. That's not the first thing that inspired or impacted me. I think I felt inspired by the people that were living, you know, that were completely aligned in terms of their ethics, that were just willing to embrace and be compassionate and to make sacrifices that you would need to make to make the world a better place and to just simply help other people around you. And so that influenced me, and I think it inspired me initially. But the scripture that I read, it shattered the illusion, you know, of fear. You know, fear is is the mind killer. I think Frank Herbert says, fear is the mind killer, and you got to get through that fear. I am a practicing Catholic, but I also read a lot of Abraham Joshua Heschel, who's a Jewish mystic. I've read four or five books by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and I was just recently at a silent retreat in Nepal at a Tibetan Buddhist monastery. So I've learned a lot from Islam, you know, and Hinduism. And so I think that whatever your source of inspiration, whether it's a faith journey, whether it's a religion, whether it's nature, whether it's something alternative, you know, we all kind of meet in the middle. You know, we find each other, we get together, and we roll our sleeves up to do the work that needs to be done to make the change that has to happen.
I love that note of taking an interdisciplinary approach when it comes to finding your influence, finding your why, and ultimately giving yourself a sense of guidance when in times of adversity. How have you effectively used an interdisciplinary approach from different authors, from different religions, to help craft a narrative that serves you and your mission?
Well, one of my favorite books of all time is by Dr. Martin Luther King. And it's a book called Why We Can't Wait. And it's in that book it's about the Birmingham sit-down strikes. It's his account of what happened with Bull Connor, you know, and that whole civil rights struggle in Alabama. And he writes a letter from the Birmingham jail. And in that letter, you know, I think I still remember what it said. I was reading this book when we were building our first school in Malawi, Africa. And in the letter, it said, more and more, I feel that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the hateful words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people. Mm. And I did not want to be one of the appalling silent people, the appallingly silent people. And at the same time, I was reading a lot of Gandhi, you know, his autobiography and his journals and his bulletins. That guy was prolific. And he was searching for ahimsa, you know, a nonviolent resistance, soul force, and perfect consistency between thought, word, and action. And these two people, one Hindu and one Protestant Christian, had such a huge impact on me that I think that they helped to provide the fuel to keep it going, you know, because shortly after that, you know, my brother and I almost died from malaria. Like, you got to dig deep to figure out how to keep going after things like that.
In terms of appalling silence, you're building this organization during a time of remarkable polarization. My family's from the Soviet Union, and they moved to the United States in the 80s and 90s. And a big part of what my parents say is, like, there was so much ridicule about them being from another country. Mm. There was so much ridicule about their perspective as somebody who was not a native, quote unquote, American. Mm. On the flip side of things, you talked about the HIV pandemic and how, yeah, you know, that was also a polarizing thing where people were afraid to even get near somebody who tested HIV positive. What made you so compelled to, quote unquote, walk in the fire, stand in the flames of adversity that were happening in that generation and accept it in open arms as opposed to reject it and run away?
I think there's a couple of things that draw me into the fire. If it's, you know, one is that it has to be done. We have to dive in. Like, when we build a school, communities organize leadership committees of six women and six men. They sign covenants committing to contributing all the labor to build the school from the ground up. And they contribute 3,000 to 4,000 volunteer workdays to build the school. And it's a partnership, and we're in some of the most remote parts of the world building these schools. And they also commit to sending their daughters to school in equal numbers with their sons. And these are people that are like in Burkina Faso, I think is the second or third poorest country on the planet economically. And Mali, which is right next to Burkina Faso in terms of that poverty index. But they unite. And there's now over 300,000 children, parents, and grandparents attending Build-On schools around the world every day. Millions have attended collectively over the last 30 years, 32 years. And that happens because they come together, that we come together in this place of solidarity. So in malaria, place like Malawi, where my brother and I suffered from malaria, I mean, Dave collapsed and went down, you know, from malaria, and he almost died. And then 8 days later, I collapsed. I had like 104 degree fever, and I have no idea what happened. I was completely gone. And Dave dragged me into one of two hospitals that they had in the country at the time. And I came out of it maybe two, three days later. I don't even know. Dave doesn't know either, because he was still in the haze of malaria himself. But the doctor said 2 more hours away from the hospital and you would have been dead.
Oh, wow.
And you know, like my veins were collapsed, it's, you know, from the dehydration, because I also had Giardia and Shigella. It's just not a good combination. Anyway, yeah, ironically, you know, Dave had to come back to the States to recover. I felt pretty good, so I decided to go back to the village. And as I'm walking back, you know, because the nearest road would only get me like to within 7 miles or so of the Missomali village where we're trying to build this school. So I'm walking the last couple miles into the village and I start to see people I recognize. And I have this terrible epiphany. You know, I realize that when they contract malaria, they don't have a near-death experience. They die. You know, why did I survive? And they don't. It's because of extreme poverty. They don't have the $20 it cost me to get good medical care that saved my life. They don't have money for mosquito nets, a dollar even, right? Or malaria prophylactics. It's terrible. And I was overwhelmed. It was one of these moments, you know, that was, I turned around. I was literally starting to walk away from the village because I was like, what do we do in the face of this? And it was just me now, right? And then I thought to myself, well, maybe if we can get that school built, they break that cycle of extreme poverty through education. And it was a naive notion, but it actually turned out to be true. And, you know, so I turned myself around and I went back into the village. And, I thought something really auspicious happened. You know, 2 weeks later, my best friend in the village, his name is Stephen Tintani, and he like had my back. He taught me a lot, you know, and he was just like on the work site every day trying to get this thing done. And he came and he had a baby girl. They just had their first little baby girl daughter, and her name's Ruthie. And I got to hold Ruthie, you know, for a few minutes, and it was really, I thought, wow. I mean, I was inhaling the moment. It felt so good until Stephen looks at me and he's like, we're going to get that school built, right? Mm. You know, and I had a pit in my stomach. I didn't know if we were going to get to school, but we never done it. I don't, you know, and then, you know, people around me are dying. The malaria was killing people, and AIDS, the infection rates were over 30% in those years in Malawi, Africa. But I looked at Stephen and I knew this guy was never going to quit. He would never give up, you know, and I was right. That guy kind of put me on his back and helped carry us across the finish line. And we got the school built, and there was 150 kids attending when I left, and I never looked back. I didn't want to go back. It was devastating. But why am I drawn to the fire? People like Stephen are in the fire. People like Ruthie are in the fire. You know, we have to unite with them. We have to connect with them. You know, we have a responsibility, I feel like. or at least I do. I feel like I have a responsibility because of the set of experiences that I've had in my life that bring me to this point. Everybody's experiences are different, but I just feel a strong sense of responsibility to be there with people like Stephen and his daughter Ruthie, and it's also fun. I mean, it's really good. I mean, building schools is awesome. I there's such an incredible clarity that comes when you're connected with a community, working side by side with 100 people, digging a foundation for a school for their children. It's going to educate generations to come. That's awesome. I mean, and that's technically in the fire too, I suppose, right? But that's solid. You got to walk through the fire to get to this place of solidarity.
I appreciate that note of you, especially noting this idea of radical empathy. I think a lot of Gen Zers, especially now, notice this sense of dissonance. There's atrocities happening across the globe, but the overall mindset is, I don't know how to empathize because I don't know how to relate. And a lot of people aren't willing to go on that trek, aren't willing to go to that foreign country to experience it on their own. Mm-hmm. And they want to experience this level of empathy and connection through a different medium, which we're fortunate enough to have now, the internet. If you were a 20-year-old with the resources that we have today, how would you go about developing this sense of radical empathy?
Oh, that's a great question. If I was a 20-year-old, how would I go about developing a radical sense of empathy and solidarity? I'm going to add to empathy. I'd just get more people out building schools, man. Let's go. We're this year alone, we're building 285 schools. We have 86 schools under construction right now. We break ground on a new school every 36 hours. And in all those villages, thousands of people are uniting with 20-year-olds that are coming from the United States, from across the country, and working together to build schools. I think that's, I think that that commitment and that willingness to go to, you know, some of the most challenging environments on the planet develops that radical sense of empathy. But if that's not for you, because it's clearly, not for everybody, there's so many opportunities to develop your empathy. And I think that the most powerful forms of that are service, reaching out to help people. And Mother Teresa, she used to say, do small things with great love. It's much better to do small things with great love than it is to do great things with small love. So I think it's just about, she had this incredible insight and simplicity in her approach. And, I had the honor of spending some time with her, and it was all about compassion, in whatever form presents itself to you. So Joey, today, 3 different opportunities will come your way to help somebody out. Maybe it's your brother. Maybe it's one of your parents. Maybe it's somebody on the street. If I was 20 and wanting to develop radical empathy, I would just do the same thing I already did, which would be to start a movement, to make change through service, through compassion. It's really straightforward, I think.
I want to magnify that Mother Teresa experience. A lot of people have read about Mother Teresa. A lot of people have heard about her. A lot of people don't even think that Mother Teresa was a real thing because it sounds so mystical, right? I mean, when I was younger, I didn't even know that Mother Teresa was a real person. Is that an image?
I took a picture of her.
That's awesome.
Yeah, she was a real person.
That is awesome.
She was totally real. She was the realest of people.
What was that experience like meeting such a, somewhat prophetic figure, somebody who influenced so many people?
Well, it was amazing. How do you describe it? I don't even know. I was on my way to Nepal to build schools, and one of my brothers was volunteering in Kaligat, which is the home for the destitute and the dying in Calcutta. And he was going to be there for a month. He was traveling around. So I stopped to visit him. And at the time, you know, we had our programs, but we weren't yet capable of taking students out to actually help build schools because we had to work out the safety issues, as you can see.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I would shoot high video, right? And I document all these experiences, and sorry about that. And bring them back to classrooms in the U.S. for our partner schools and do talks and classes about these experiences to help connect the students to this cause. So the kids, before I went to, they heard I was going to Calcutta, and they're like, well, we got some questions for Mother Teresa. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to see Mother Teresa. You're like, it's a big, huge city of many millions of people. I doubt, you know. But they gave me all these questions they wanted me to ask her, and I took them, and I had my, you know, I always had the video. I always had a SLR 35 millimeter camera too. And I was there, and if you go to mass in the morning, there she is, you know, in a little chapel. We all sat on the floor and kneeled on the floor, maybe 50 people. I talked to one of the sisters and said, hey, do you think I could interview Mother Teresa? These kids have these questions they want me to ask. And she said, well, we'll think about it. And then like 2 days later, after mass, the nun, Sister Priscilla, I think her name was, she said, do you still want to talk to Mother? And I was like, yeah. And she said, okay, does now work for you? And I'm like, absolutely. So, you know, she went back and got Mother Teresa, and she's like 4.5 feet tall. She's just this tiny woman, and she's shuffling, you know, and she's a little hunched over, and I see her coming, and you just have this immediate feeling of like joy, you know. She's like your favorite grandparent type energy, you know. It's just and you can't stop smiling, right? And she's coming, and I'm looking down, getting ready to greet her. And all of a sudden she looks up, and she had put her hand on my head and gave me a blessing. She's like, God bless you. Thank you for coming and being with us, you know, or something like that. And you're just like, oh, you know, it was wonderful. But that energy that she had, it's just compassion. We all are capable of that compassion. Anyway, so, you know, they gave me, a permission to film and do all sorts of stuff. And, you know, it was a powerful experience, and I shared it out as much as I could. Again, this is before social media was around, but I think that the reason that experience happened was to bolster, you know, my own sense of motivation to keep doing what we're doing.
I want to dive a little bit deeper into the idea of cultural difference. I'm sure when you look at Western African countries and how they're navigating, you know, the school build versus in Harlem, right? There's ultimately difference. How did you go about navigating difference?
You know, I don't even think about the differences. It just never even crosses my mind. And I think over, you know, all those early years, I spent 3 years living in different mud huts around the world, and I had to completely surrender myself to the people I was with because I depended on them, you know, and I didn't have language skills. You know, I couldn't speak Chichewa in Malawi, and yet I'm embedded in this village for like 5 or 6 months. And there's a power of intention. And there's, I think, surrendering yourself to an experience, into a community, opens up that community to accept you for who you are. And by immersing and being there and living, you know, sleeping on the floor of a mud hut and living the way they live, they trust you. And, you know, it's not like you're blowing through there in a big old SUV. We didn't have anything like that. And you drop off the materials and say, go build a school. It was like deep solidarity, connection with each other. And so, I mean, the differences, you even forget when I came out of the villages. Sometimes after a couple of months, I'd see another white person. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, it's because I haven't seen one in a long time, and it's kind of jarring. And Because I guess my point is that you forget about the differences and you kind of surrender yourself to trust, you know, and to, you know, pushing through with compassion, you know, and things just work out one way or the other. I mean, I've had 3 or 4 near-death experiences, but I'm still here. I'm 57 years old. So things just keep working out.
Your work with Build On is centered around building community, solving divide, building cohesion, all through a sense of radical empathy. What would you recommend a young person do to build a solid sense of community with those who are different to themselves?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think the best thing to do is to confront your own fears and anxieties about people who look or act a little differently than you, to meet people where they are, you know, go into communities where people are different than you are, and find ways to serve and serve each other. And well, you know, so last week I on Wednesdays, I go down to the South Bronx, and ironically enough, I volunteer at a shelter run by the Missionaries of Charity, a men's shelter, Mother Teresa's outfit. I'm still into it. Anyway, I got connected with them because of the Build On students were doing service there. And I went to do service with the Build On. I hadn't been around, Mother Teresa was a one-time thing. And then 20 years later, our kids are doing service at Missionaries of Charity shelter in the Bronx. So I go, and the sisters are just like Mother Teresa. They're just as compassionate, just as wonderful and luminous. It's amazing. Anyway, they're so humble and so simple. And we're serving people meals. And then one of the sisters is like, "Can you stay overnight tonight?" And I'm like, "Here?" And she's like, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, why do you want me to stay overnight?" And she said, "Well, this is a men's shelter and we can't stay. It's an open dorm room with like 20 beds per floor." And she said, "We can't stay in the dorms because, you know, we're nuns." And I said, "Well, I can't stay tonight, but I'd come back next week and do it, you know," because I had little kids at home and I had responsibilities. And I came back and I'm just so hooked. I love it. And so on Wednesdays, I go to the South Bronx and I work with the Build On students, the high school kids, and we pack grocery bags for about 150 families that immigrated from Venezuela. And they come and we chat and, you know, we share out the food. And then the Build On kids go home and I stay there. And it's just awesome. Like being connecting with these guys, you know, and I don't know. I just decide what's important to you. Right. You know, maybe it's the environment. Hopefully it is. It's important to me. It should be important to everybody. You know, get involved in service that will strengthen our environment. Or maybe it's if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, it's the 120 encampments of unhoused people. So go get on in there, you know, and start sharing out and doing service. Find good community-based organizations that are doing solid work and volunteer, you know, and I think that there's nothing that builds community more profoundly than serving side by side with each other. You know what I mean? It's awesome. It's an exchange too. Service isn't one way. People always come out, they come to build a school, you know, because we'll take, you know, 50 or 60 teams of people to build schools this year over to these countries, and they immerse for 1 to 2 weeks. And they always think they're giving something to the community out of this benevolence. And then they come back in tears, like it just isn't that way. I learned more. I grew more. It's an exchange. It's a partnership. It's not a charity. You know, we're not a charity. And I'm not suggesting people should be a charity, you know, give things away. I'm asking you to serve, to be in solidarity.
It's interesting how you take more of a nonprofit angle when it comes to service. but there's a lot of other people doing a lot of different types of work, sometimes for profit, sometimes for corporations, who still want to leave a meaningful impact in their own sector. I'm interested as to how you think those people could navigate making their careers more impact-based, more service-based.
Well, it's a good time. Gen Z is coming up and millennials before you. And these generations, your generation is cause for optimism because you are seeking that sense of purpose that you just asked about. And I think that it is impacting capitalism. I'm seeing it. Like, I have CEOs on my board of directors. The CEO of Fortune magazine's on my board of directors. And he talks about this thing called stakeholder capitalism, where leadership in the corporate community will not succeed unless it's authentic, unless it's benefiting people, unless there's purpose behind it. And even the share prices indicate that the more successful companies are the ones that are purpose driven. And so you can and should demand, well, you know, demand's a strong word. Sometimes I feel like I'm a little too radical. You can and should pursue purpose at work. Ask the questions, you know, and Salesforce is a great example. They're a partner of ours and they have this ethic around 111. I can't remember exactly what all the ones stand for, but they advocate for their employees to do service. They get so many days off a year just to go out into the community and serve. When you're building a product, you know, if you come across something that is ethically compromising, bring it up. You know, it takes courage, right? But you got to bring these things up and you got to be willing to take a stand sometimes. I mean, there's a lot of discussion right now around the value or the problems and the divisiveness caused by social media. Well, there's an opportunity for Gen Z to dig in there and turn that around, man. I was so moved and inspired by your sense of purpose and what you're doing specifically to change the narrative on social media, to bring people together instead of dividing them, you know? And so if you're in corporate America, if you're there, you will find opportunities to serve. You will find opportunities to make a difference. You will find opportunities to guide those incredible organizations to a more wholesome place. You will. You know, you're the leaders of tomorrow. You're the leaders of today. Forget about tomorrow. Leadership should start right now. And I'm really inspired by you, Joey, and by the community at the Creator Camp, and also the whole generation and the way you're pursuing purpose. It was not like that when I was coming up. People thought I was crazy, dude. Like, they were very concerned about me. So, but now, you know, it's cool. Everybody's ready to go and dive in and do something important.
They often say that the fish stinks from the head. Of course, people who are employees of organizations oftentimes have a deep sense of wanting to give back. I know that when I was working at a company last summer, there was a huge level of commitment to the employee population to do service work together. And that oftentimes stemmed from leadership guiding that narrative. There's a lot of companies, though, that haven't caught up to pace with that, and their leadership hasn't caught up to the paces of prioritizing service. What would you recommend the leaders of today and also the leaders of tomorrow do to change that paradigm from the top down?
You ask a very good question, and I think you ask it correctly. What do you do to change the paradigm shift from the top down? In our experience, if you're able to get one significant, well-known leader to take the plunge, to do the service, to build a school, other leaders want to do it. And I'll tell you like what I think is kind of a humorous story, but it's cause for optimism. So 6 or 7 years ago, you know, we would send 80 teams of people to West Africa that, and they fund the construction of a school. It costs like $35,000 to build a school. People crowdsource, raise the money, and then they go and spend a couple of weeks helping to dig the foundation, put the foundation in Senegal. And it's 105 degrees, right? And it's blistering. And it, you know, and you're sleeping on the floor of a mud hut. And they come back enlightened, you know, just completely different people, which is cool. And it would, and they would pay their own way to get there. We would have our teams that would support them in the field, of course, but it was a, an immersive experience. So people were willing to go from, you know, Wall Street to West Africa, but they weren't willing to go from Wall Street 5 miles north to the South Bronx. They were afraid, you know, to do it. And we got connected with the CEO or the global, I don't know what the title is for McKinsey, the CEO of McKinsey and Company. And I challenged him. I said, let's go. Come on up to the Bronx. Bring your people with you and we'll do an immersion. And this guy's name is Dominic Barton. And he did. He took me up on it. And we spent a day and a half. We called it a 36-hour immersion. And you're paired up one by, you know, with one other, with a build on a kid from a school in the South Bronx. And you do a lot of team building and you learn about each other and you collaborate just with your partner. And then you do service together. And this guy, Dominic, came out of that experience fired up. He's like, you know, I talk to 2 to 3 CEOs per day about leadership. I've been talking to the wrong people. These kids, they're the true leaders, because he saw these incredible characteristics in them: compassion, empathy, courage, resilience, passion for the possible, solidarity. And so we collaborated with McKinsey and built out like a learning platform so that when people could, we could replicate that experience. And then he told the CEO of Fortune magazine about it, Alan Murray. And Alan came to the Bronx and did the same thing. And he loved it. And he wrote about it in Fortune. And then more people, a co-founder of Salesforce, the CEOs of different banks. And they're coming and doing service. You know, and so, and we charge them. We charge them $36,000 for a 36-hour experience. And all the funding goes to fuel our programs. So, I mean, it's amazing to think that we couldn't have paid people enough to get them to the South Bronx, but now they're paying us, because that is the power of, I think, of solidarity and service. Once you can break through all the misconceptions. So I think it's cause for optimism. Your generation, even the leaders right now, there's a solid movement. You know, there's a groundswell here.
A lot of us struggle with work-life balance, of being able to juggle our passions, our life, and our work all in one. And I think that also carries through into work-service balance. A lot of us struggle to take care of ourselves at a baseline, to do that exercise, to go to therapy, to journal, to spend time with our family, but also to do service. How would you recommend people carve out that time?
Well, I mean, the Dalai Lama says we should pursue a mind of clear light through compassion, which means that we can find clarity. We can conquer fears, anxiety, stresses through compassion. I mean, every Dalai Lama before him said the same thing. It's all about compassion. And I think that if we pursue a life that's balanced with compassion, we're going to have a lot of fun. And we're gonna help people. We're gonna make real impact. And when you're my age, looking back, you're gonna be okay. I'm glad I did that, you know. And in terms of work-life balance, it's a real thing, especially with, you know, I can do everything from this phone right here, you know. And all my work is right there, right in my pocket all the time. So it requires discipline. So, for me, I get up at 5 a.m. Because I have a special needs son, and I have to get him up at 6. And so I get up at 5 and I meditate, journal and meditate for an hour. And then I get my son Jack up and help him get, you know, ready for school and whatnot, get him on the little bus. And he's 19 now. He's graduating high school, which is a miracle. Anyway, so I've been doing this for 19 years with Jack. So I get up, I get him on the school bus, and then I go to the woods and I ride my mountain bike. And I get to work at about 9 o'clock, but I've already been awake for 4 hours, you know, and I've been able to meditate and pray, and I've been able to spend some important time with my son and my wife and my other son. And I got to ride my mountain bike and have some fun and be in the woods and the riverside. And then I go to work. And so it helps. And I try to, you know, I'm fortunate because I have control over my own calendar. Not everybody does. But man, when I can go home at 6, I go home at 6. I don't stay and work another hour or 2 hours. I go home at 6 and just be with the family. Joey, I'm guessing you don't have a family yet. You look pretty young, but you know, go hang out with your friends. So it takes some discipline and it takes practice. You know, I've been doing it for so long that I'm not right if I don't meditate. I'm just like my wife will say, you got to get back up there, man, and meditate because you're not right today. So it's really held me together for 32 years. I haven't always had good work-life balance though, truth be told. You know, early days I was working crazy hours, 80, 90, 100 hours. And you're in the village, it's 24/7 really. But you know, once we got the momentum, I was able to start balancing things out. So maybe there's going to be periods in your career early, hopefully only in your career, where more is required, you know, get it done and then get back to your balanced your best self.
Jim, we typically end off these episodes with three core questions. The first of which is, what is something that you've recently changed your mind on?
I change my mind on things. I feel like as soon as I learn something new, it requires me to change my mind on something, right? So the bigger things I've changed my mind on recently are, we collect a lot of data. And with our programs, our students contribute service. We count all the hours of service that they do, and there's an IPARD service learning model that we adhere to. And I believed that for Build On to really make an impact in somebody's life, they got to do at least 50 hours of service per year. And in 2017, 18, and 19, we collected data on 22,000 kids, half of them in Build On, half of them not, but all going to the same schools, so the same environment. And we found that when kids got involved in Build On, they came to school on average 15 days more per year, which is the difference between dropout and graduation. Huge. We also learned, because the evaluators just were able to use a lot of regression analysis and extract different conclusions from the data, that the first hour of service that a kid does is the number one most important. Because that's when they decide if they're going to come back and do it again or do a second hour. And the second hour is second most important, and third, et cetera, until you get to like around 24, 25 hours. When you get to 25 hours of service, you come to school 15 more days per year. But when you get to 50, you come to school 15.2 more days per year. So it's sort of it all becomes self-sustaining. If a kid does that much service, they're going to keep coming because they're hooked. It's addictive. It's fun. So we changed our whole KPI platform, key performance indicator platform, so that we reached more kids for less time. Instead of fewer kids for 50 hours, we wanted to spread, you know, K cast the net wider and get more kids in. And just our goal is to get them to do 25 hours of service over the course of a school year because of what the data showed us. So that was a big shift, you know, because I walked around thinking we had to do 50 forever until we got the data, you know, and data tells the truth. There's a lot of wisdom there.
Mm. It seems as though with your organization, there's not, you know, any critics. I couldn't see anybody criticizing, you know, the work that you're doing. But suppose that there was, and they were sitting right in front of you right now. What's one piece of, you know, information that you would impart to this captive audience of critics to potentially change their mind?
I don't think you're going to be too surprised by my answer at this point, Joey. So first I would ask a lot of questions and listen very respectfully, you know, to understand what they're criticizing. Because of course we can improve. I mean, you got to tell yourself the truth. We can always get better at what we do, and the critics have a lot of good ideas, you know, on how we can get better. So I'd listen respectfully, and then I would respond, either by taking action to make change that they're suggesting, or respond with, you know, the methodology and the reason and the purpose behind certain things that we do and why we do them. And then I'd invite them to come build a school. They find out for themselves. You know, I had this one cynical guy that was just like, they're billionaires, you know, with a B. And he was so cynical about Build On, you know, and he was just firing out these questions and it was just one-on-one. It wasn't like a public thing, a panel or anything. But I said, you know what? I answered all his questions and I said, you know what? Just come build a school. You decide, because we go beyond transparency at Build On. We go into solidarity. So you experience it. You see what's happening, and you'll see that there are flaws. It's not perfect, but it's powerful. So I would just invite people. I invite the critics to join us, to give it a shot. And then if they still want to criticize, that's cool. I'm sure they got ideas on how we can get better.
Mm. Use criticism as a means of improvement is something that we oftentimes try and embody most on this podcast in particular. And we also look towards things that are giving us hope as a guiding narrative to continue recording as well. What is giving you hope in the world right now?
Oh man, everything. There's so many things that are giving me hope. You know, we're bombarded with a lot of negative things happening in the media and otherwise, and violent things. You know, yesterday, our staff was in a school where there was an active shooter in Detroit, Michigan, and there was a big lockdown. I was in a lockdown in the South Bronx not that long ago. It's crazy, you know, and then you see all these mass shootings and all this violence and what's happening in Ukraine and in Russia right now and in the Sudan. And it's anyway. So there's a lot of negative out there, but there's so much more that's positive. There's so much more reason to have hope than there is not. It's just that we have to keep our eyes open and we have to be mindful and see them. One of the things that I think right now that really inspires me is a Build On alumni. So this is a kid that went through our programs on the south side of Chicago. And I was in Nepal with him and 18 or 19 other alum and students from our programs. And we were in this human chain passing these big giant river rocks from one person to the next that we were going to use in the foundation. And you know, it's amazing. So there's 100 people in the human chain and all these people from the village. And it's just, that is like a picture of solidarity, passing rocks or whatever it is, cement sometimes from one person to the next to get it over there and put in the foundation of a school that's going to be there for 100 years. So anyway, that in and of itself is really cool. But I'm standing next to this guy. His name is Othello, and he's like 6'2", 260 pounds. looks like, you know, a nose guard in the NFL. Like he could play nose. He's a big dude. He's from the South Side of Chicago. And he's like, you know, Jim, I've been meaning to talk to you. And I'm like, okay. You know, and he's like, every time I have a tough experience in my life, I feel like I think of Bildon. And I'm like, all right. What do you mean? Tell me what's going on. And he explained that he was raised in an orphanage, a Carmelite orphanage in Chicago, with 120 boys, a boys' home, 120 kids. And he said, you know, that was pretty rough. But he explained that he got a scholarship to a football powerhouse because he was a prodigy, you know, and he was just super bright kid too. So he's tracking to go play D1 college football. You know, and he's a freshman in high school, and he said he was as big as he is now back then. And he said, but then his best friend back at the home told him that he was in trouble, you know, that he had stole drugs from a rival gang leader. And this kid was affiliated, not Othello, but the other kid was gang affiliated. And Othello, you know, he felt like he had to have his friend's back. And Othello said, you know, either they're going to come and get us or we're going to go get them. And so he said they got a couple of Smith and Wessons and they went after this gang leader. And there was a big shootout. And the lead gang leader was shot and the police came. He wasn't killed, thank God. And Othello's friend, you know, he was, you know, arrested right away. So was Othello. And Othello was the judge was sympathetic. I saw something special about him, but only gave him probation. He didn't discharge his weapon. You know, he didn't shoot anybody. So, but he got probation, and it meant he had to wear an ankle bracelet at the age of 15. And so he got kicked off the football team and lost his scholarship. So then he ends up in a Bildon High School, Clark. I think it's called Clark Academy on the South Side. And somebody invites him to join Bildon. He doesn't know anybody. So he's like, okay, I'll join Bildon. And he likes doing service. He likes to prepare and serve meals to people. That's his favorite thing. And then he goes to Haiti to build a school. And then he comes back and then he's doing pretty well. He gets a scholarship to University of Iowa and he's killing it, but he's bored. He says it's too easy. The kid is super smart, like genius level IQ. So he drops out and he starts selling Porsches, if you can believe, Porsche cars, you know, luxury cars. And he's making $150,000 a year selling Porsches. And then he sells a Porsche to like some executive vice president at IBM. And the guy like realizes how smart Othello is. So he offers him a job. So Othello gets into quantum mechanics and IBM sending him around Europe teaching quantum mechanics to their people. And he's 20 years old and now he's making $220,000. And then he decides to go find his mother, his birth mother, you know, because when you're 18, you can do that. And he finds her and they have this powerful emotional reunion. And then he meets his two brothers that he never met. You know, they're half brothers, I guess. And then COVID hits. And then Othello, one of his brothers was in Las Vegas and couldn't get home because, you know, everything got shut down. So Othello and his mom and his other brother drove from Chicago to Vegas to pick up the brother. And then they somehow end up getting COVID. You know, one of those got COVID. They were in the car together. And it was like the Delta variant early days, you know. And so Othello collapses and his heart stops. And they broke three ribs trying to get his heart going again. And they never did. They got him into life support, though, in the intensive care unit. And they were able to keep his blood pumping through. He showed me the port where they had to put some tubes in to keep pumping his blood and the oxygen for 2 hours. So he was technically dead, you know, for 2 hours. And then he was in a coma for 2 weeks. And then he's like, you wouldn't believe what was going on with me in that coma. And I'm like, what was going on? You know, he's got me on the edge of my seat. We're still passing the rocks back and forth. And he said, well, I kept having these visions that I was building a school again in Haiti, you know, and I could see the finished school up on a hill. And it was this golden light and I could hear the school bell ringing. And it was, he says, Jim, it was a first person experience. I was in it. Right. And he said it just kept happening. And then when he came out of the coma, there's hazmat people with hazmat suits everywhere. And, you know, that he had to relearn how to walk. He couldn't, you know, he was paralyzed for not too long, luckily. And then he found out his mom didn't make it. She died from COVID. And he was devastated because he had her for such a short period of time. And one of the last things they were talking about is her asking him to go back to college, saying, come on, you know, you got to do that. She couldn't go to college, you know, and she couldn't go to college. For a bunch of reasons. And so once he got out of the hospital, he applied to come on this alumni trek where I met him in Nepal, you know, building a school. And then he applied, got back into college. He's going to Columbia University. He got a full scholarship. Wow. The dude is a rocket scientist in terms of IQ. And Othello is cause for hope. That guy with his determination, with his courage, you know, and his empathy and his resilience, never giving up, right? And his passion for the possible, his solidarity, I mean, that's cause for hope. And there's so many kids like Othello out there doing important things and rising above all the challenges. And they are what inspire me. They're what keep me going for sure. It's amazing.
Jim, I'll say it time and time again. It's been an honor and pleasure to have you on the podcast and for you to share your story. And I can't wait to upload this. So thank you again.
Yeah, you're welcome. Joey, thanks. Thank you. Thanks to you and your brother for doing the work that you're doing and raising the profile on the things that are happening with Build On and other important organizations. It's really important. And you are cause for optimism too.